Today we'll be continuing The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Chapter 6, Part 1. About this time, an ambitious young reporter from New York arrived one morning at Gatsby's door and asked him if he had anything to say.
"Anything to say about what?"
inquired Gatsby politely.
"Why, any statement to give out."
It transpired after a confused 5 minutes that the man had heard Gatsby's name around his office in a connection which he either wouldn't reveal or didn't fully understand. This was his day off, and with laudable initiative, he had hurried out to see. It was a random shot, and yet the reporter's instinct was right. Gatsby's notoriety spread about by the hundreds who had accepted his hospitality and so become authorities upon his past, had increased all summer until he fell just short of being news. Contemporary legends, such as the underground pipeline to Canada, attached themselves to him. And there was one persistent story that he didn't live in a house at all, but in a boat that looked like a house and was moved secretly up and down the Long Island shore. Just why these inventions were a source of satisfaction to James Gatz of North Dakota isn't easy to say. James Gatz. That was really, or at least legally, his name. He had changed it at the age of 17, and at the specific moment that witnessed the beginning of his career, when he saw Dan Cody's yacht drop anchor over the most insidious flat on Lake Superior. It was James Gatz who had been loafing along the beach that afternoon in a torn green jersey and a pair of canvas pants. But it was already Jay Gatsby who borrowed a rowboat, pulled out to the Ptolemy, and informed Cody that a wind might catch him and break him up in half an hour. I suppose he'd had the name ready for a long time, even then. His parents were shiftless and unsuccessful farm people. His imagination had never really accepted them as parents at all. The truth was that Jay Gatsby of West Egg, Long Island, sprang from his platonic conception of himself. He was a son of God, a phrase which, if it means anything, means just that. And he must be about his father's business, the service of a vast, vulgar, and meretricious beauty. So he invented just the sort of Jay Gatsby that a 17-year-old boy would be likely to invent. And to this conception, he was faithful to the end. For over a year, he had been beating his way along the south shore of Lake Superior as a clam digger and a salmon fisher, or in any other capacity that brought him food and bed. His brown, hardening body lived naturally through the half-fierce, half-lazy work of the bracing days. He knew women early, and since they spoiled him, he became contemptuous of them. Of young virgins, because they were ignorant. Of the others, because they were hysterical about things which in his overwhelming self-absorption he took for granted. But his heart was in a constant, turbulent riot. The most grotesque and fantastic conceits haunted him in his bed at night. A universe of ineffable gaudiness spun itself out in his brain, while the clock ticked on the washstand, and the moon soaked with wet light his tangled clothes upon the floor. Each night, he added to the pattern of his fancies, until drowsiness closed down upon some vivid scene with an oblivious embrace. For a while, these reveries provided an outlet for his imagination. They were a satisfactory hint of the unreality of reality, a promise that the rock of the world was founded securely on a fairy's wing. An instinct toward its future glory had led him, some months before, to the small Lutheran college of St. Olaf's in southern Minnesota. He stayed there 2 weeks, dismayed at its ferocious indifference to the drums of his destiny, to destiny itself, and despising the janitor's work with which he was to pay his way through. Then he drifted back to Lake Superior, and he was still searching for something to do on the day that Dan Cody's yacht dropped anchor in the shallows along shore. Cody was 50 years old then, a product of the Nevada silver fields, of the Yukon, of every rush for metal since 75. The transactions in Montana copper that made him many times a millionaire found him physically robust but on the verge of soft-mindedness. And suspecting this, an infinite number of women tried to separate him from his money. The none-too-savory ramifications by which Ella Kay, the newspaper woman, played Madame de Maintenon to his weakness and sent him to sea in a yacht were common property of the turgid journalism of 1902.
He had been coasting along all too hospitable shores for 5 years when he turned up as James Gatz's destiny in Little Girl Bay. To young Gatz, resting on his oars and looking up at the railed deck, that yacht represented all the beauty and glamour in the world. I suppose he smiled at Cody. He had probably discovered that people liked him when he smiled. At any rate, Cody asked him a few questions. One of them elicited the brand new name, and found that he was quick and extravagantly ambitious. A few days later, he took him to Duluth and bought him a blue coat, 6 pairs of white duck trousers, and a yachting cap. And when the Ptolemy left for the West Indies and the Barbary Coast, Gatsby left too. He was employed in a vague personal capacity while he remained with Cody. He was in turn steward, mate, skipper, secretary, and even jailer, for Dan Cody sober knew what lavish doings Dan Cody drunk might soon be about, and he provided for such contingencies by reposing more and more trust in Gatsby. The arrangement lasted 5 years, during which the boat went 3 times around the continent. It might have lasted indefinitely, except for the fact that Ella Kay came on board one night in Boston. And a week later, Dan Cody inhospitably died. I remember the portrait of him up in Gatsby's bedroom. A gray, florid man with a hard, empty face. The pioneer debauchee, who during one phase of American life brought back to the eastern seaboard the savage violence of the frontier brothel and saloon. It was indirectly due to Cody that Gatsby drank so little. Sometimes, in the course of gay parties, women used to rub champagne into his hair. For himself, he formed the habit of letting liquor alone. And it was from Cody that he inherited money, a legacy of $25,000. He didn't get it. He never understood the legal device that was used against him. But what remained of the millions went intact to Ella Kay. He was left with his singularly appropriate education. The vague contour of Jay Gatsby had filled out to the substantiality of a man. He told me all this very much later, but I've put it down here with the idea of exploding those first wild rumors about his antecedents, which weren't even faintly true. Moreover, he told it to me at a time of confusion, when I had reached the point of believing everything and nothing about him. So I take advantage of this short halt, while Gatsby, so to speak, caught his breath, to clear this set of misconceptions away. It was a halt, too, in my association with his affairs. For several weeks, I didn't see him or hear his voice on the phone. Mostly, I was in New York, trotting around with Jordan and trying to ingratiate myself with her senile aunt. But finally, I went over to his house one Sunday afternoon. I hadn't been there 2 minutes when somebody brought Tom Buchanan in for a drink. I was startled, naturally. But the really surprising thing was that it hadn't happened before. They were a party of 3 on horseback. Tom, and a man named Sloane, and a pretty woman in a brown riding habit who had been there previously. "I'm delighted to see you," said Gatsby, standing on his porch. "I'm delighted that you dropped in." As though they cared. "Sit right down. Have a cigarette or a cigar." He walked around the room quickly, ringing bells. "I'll have something to drink for you in just a minute." He was profoundly affected by the fact that Tom was there. But he would be uneasy anyhow until he had given them something, realizing in a vague way that that was all they came for. Mr. Sloane wanted nothing. A lemonade? No thanks. A little champagne? Nothing at all, thanks. "I'm sorry. Did you have a nice ride?" "Very good roads around here." "I suppose the automobiles." "Yeah." Moved by an irresistible impulse, Gatsby turned to Tom, who had accepted the introduction as a stranger. "I believe we've met somewhere before, Mr. Buchanan." "Oh, yes," said Tom, gruffly polite, but obviously not remembering. "So we did. I remember very well. About 2 weeks ago." "That's right. You were with Nick here. I know your wife," continued Gatsby, almost aggressively. "That's so." Tom turned to me. "You live near here, Nick?" "Next door." "That's so." Mr. Sloane didn't enter into the conversation, but lounged back haughtily in his chair. The woman said nothing either, until, unexpectedly, after 2 highballs, she became cordial. "Well, I'll come over to your next party, Mr. Gatsby," she suggested. "What do you say? Certainly. I'd be delighted to have you.
Be very nice, said Mr. Sloan without gratitude.
Well, thank God to be starting home.
Please don't hurry, Gadsby urged them. He had control of himself now, and he wanted to see more of Tom.
Why don't you stay for supper? I wouldn't be surprised if some other people dropped in from New York.
You come to supper with me, said the lady enthusiastically.
Both of you.
This included me.
Mr. Sloan got to his feet. Come along, he said.
But to her only. I mean it, she insisted. I'd love to have you. Lots of room.
Gadsby looked at me questioningly. He wanted to go, and he didn't see that Mr. Sloan had determined he shouldn't.
I'm afraid I won't be able to, I said.
Well, you come, she urged, concentrating on Gadsby.
Mr. Sloan murmured something close to her ear.
We won't be late if we start now, she insisted aloud.
I haven't got a horse, said Gadsby. I used to ride in the army, but I've never bought a horse. I'll have to follow you in my car. Excuse me for just a minute.
The rest of us walked out on the porch, where Sloan and the lady began an impassioned conversation aside.
My God, I believe the man's coming, said Tom. Doesn't he know she doesn't want him?
She says she does want him.
She has a big dinner party, and he won't know a soul there.
He frowned.
I wonder where in the devil he met Daisy.
My God, I may be old-fashioned in my ideas, but women run around too much these days to suit me. They meet all kinds of crazy fish.
Suddenly, Mr. Sloan and the lady walked down the steps and mounted their horses.
Come on, said Mr. Sloan to Tom. We're late. We've got to go.
And then to me.
Tell him we couldn't wait, will you?
Tom and I shook hands. The rest of us exchanged a cool nod, and they trotted quickly down the drive, disappearing under the August foliage just as Gadsby, with hat and light overcoat in hand, came out the front door. Tom was evidently perturbed at Daisy's running around alone. For on the following Saturday night, he came with her to Gadsby's party. Perhaps his presence gave the evening its peculiar quality of oppressiveness. It stands out in my memory from Gadsby's other parties that summer. There were the same people, or at least the same sort of people. The same profusion of champagne, the same many-colored, many-keyed commotion. But I felt an unpleasantness in the air, a pervading harshness that hadn't been there before. Or perhaps I'd merely grown used to it, grown to accept West Egg as a world complete in itself, with its own standards and its own great figures, second to nothing because it had no consciousness of being so. And now I was looking at it again through Daisy's eyes. It is invariably saddening to look through new eyes at things upon which you have expended your own powers of adjustment. They arrived at twilight. And as we strolled out among the sparkling hundreds, Daisy's voice was playing murmurous tricks in her throat.
These things excite me so, she whispered. If you want to kiss me any time during the evening, Nick, just let me know and I'll be glad to arrange it for you. Just mention my name or present a green card. I'm giving out green...
Look around, suggested Gadsby.
I'm looking around. I'm having a marvelous...
You must see the faces of many people you've heard about.
Tom's arrogant eyes roamed the crowd.
We don't go around very much, he said. In fact, I was just thinking I don't know a soul here. Perhaps you know that lady.
Gadsby indicated a gorgeous, scarcely human orchid of a woman who sat in state under a white plum tree. Tom and Daisy stared with that peculiarly unreal feeling that accompanies the recognition of a hitherto ghostly celebrity of the movies.
She's lovely, said Daisy.
The man bending over her is her director.
He took them ceremoniously from group to group.
Mrs. Buchanan and Mr. Buchanan.
After an instant's hesitation, he added,
The polo player.
Oh, no, objected Tom quickly. Not me.
But evidently the sound of it pleased Gadsby, for Tom remained the polo player for the rest of the evening.
I've never met so many celebrities, Daisy exclaimed. I liked that man.
What was his name? With a sort of blue nose. Gadsby identified him, adding that he was a small producer.
Well, I liked him anyhow.
I'd a little rather not be the polo player, said Tom pleasantly.
I'd rather look at all these famous people in oblivion.
Daisy and Gadsby danced.
I remember being surprised by his graceful, conservative foxtrot. I had never seen him dance before. Then they sauntered over to my house and sat on the steps for half an hour, while at her request I remained watchfully in the garden. In case there's a fire or a flood, she explained, or any act of God. Tom appeared from his oblivion as we were sitting down to supper together.
Do you mind if I eat with some people over here? He said. A fellow's getting off some funny stuff.
Go ahead, answered Neely. And if you want to take down any addresses, here's my little gold pencil.
She looked around after a moment and told me the girl was common but pretty. And I knew that except for the half hour she'd been alone with Gadsby, she wasn't having a good time. We were at a particularly tipsy table. That was my fault. Gadsby had been called to the phone, and I'd enjoyed these same people only 2 weeks before. But what had amused me then turned septic on the air now.
How do you feel, Miss Baedecker?
The girl addressed was trying, unsuccessfully, to slump against my shoulder. At this inquiry, she sat up and opened her eyes.
What?
A massive and lethargic woman who had been urging Daisy to play golf with her at the local club tomorrow spoke in Miss Baedecker's defense.
Oh, she's all right. When she's had 5 or 6 cocktails, she always starts screaming like that. I tell her she ought to leave it alone.
I do leave it alone, affirmed the accused hollowly.
We heard you yelling, so I said to Doc Civet here, there's somebody that needs your help, Doc.
She's much obliged, I'm sure, said another friend without gratitude. But you got her dress all wet when you stuck her head in the pool.
Anything I hate is to get my head stuck in a pool, mumbled Miss Baedecker. They almost drowned me once over in New Jersey.
Then you ought to leave it alone, countered Doc Civet.
Speak for yourself,
cried Miss Baedecker violently.
Your hand shakes. I wouldn't let you operate on me.
It was like that. Among the last thing I remember was standing with Daisy and watching the moving picture director and his star. They were still under the white plum tree, and their faces were touching except for a pale, thin ray of moonlight between. It occurred to me that he had been very slowly bending toward her all evening to attain this proximity. And even while I watched, I saw him stoop one ultimate degree and kiss at her cheek.
Thank you for joining Bite at a Time Books today, while we read a bite of one of your favorite classics. Again, my name is Bree Carlisle, and I hope you come back tomorrow for the next bite of The Great Gatsby.